Chapter 6. Comrades, Black Oculus, Observer.
Origo.
Cord spoke the name carefully. His head was swimming, hovering somewhere on the boundary between exhaustion and hallucination.
Origo,
he said again, checking as he did so that the vox was set to the scout machine's frequency.
Yes, sir,
came Origo's voice, dry and wrung out. Cord licked his lips. His tongue was dry. They had lost the quarry 3 days before. The Iron Warriors had simply vanished. One second the scouts were saying that they could see them, and the next the vox was filled with confusion. Finally, a numb resignation settled into Cord like ice water. The Auspex screens were showing merely static, as though the air itself had become nothing but a blizzard of distortion. They had carried on for another 12 hours on the same heading after they had lost their quarry. No one spoke, except to check headings and status. Cord remained quiet, even as the instinct to ask for fresh reports itched at him. They had settled into the silence for 4 hours, and at the end of it, Cord had given the order to move out on the same bearing as before. No one had said anything, other than the briefest of acknowledgements. That had been 2 weeks before. 2 weeks of pushing onwards, sipping recycled water and nutripaste from tubes inside the suit. They had not seen anything in that time. Not a silhouette of a vehicle, not a scratch of code on the wind. At first he had been able to hear the tension in the voices of the others over the vox. Then that had faded to a dull monotone, which blended with the fog beyond. Even Sasha and the rest of his own crew had faded into soundlessness. He could not say he blamed them. He was not sure if he felt alive himself.
"Was there something, Colonel?"
asked Origo. Cord breathed. He was not sure why he had begun this.
"What should I do, Origo?"
The words came before he could help them. They hung in the pause that followed.
"I sound so weak," he thought. "Weak, broken, cracked."
"With all due respect, sir, that is not how the chain of command works."
Cord almost laughed. He felt giddy.
"We won't find them again, will we, Origo? The ghost I was following is gone, isn't it?"
"If this is the old flats south of Kusank, then we could travel the 200 kilometres we have already covered again before we saw its edge. They might be anywhere within that space, or somewhere else entirely."
Origo did not add the implication of those facts. He did not need to. Cord clicked the vox to reply, but said nothing. After several seconds of fizzing silence, he released the transmission key. He closed his eyes, but kept the vox open. He began to notice the heat and noise of the machine, the warm clamminess of sweat on the seals of his suit, the stuttered clatter of the tracks turning, the way that Sasha twisted to get comfortable every few minutes. It was as though his mind and senses were reaching for something to take the place of the thought that kept rattling through him.
"I was wrong."
3 hours after the last sighting, he called a full halt. The regiment had scattered into a ring, guns and sensors facing outwards, power, heat and air turned down to a minimum. He had ordered all crews to sleep. He wondered, however, how many of them would sleep. He could not. He knew that without trying. After several minutes, he opened the vox to Origo again.
"Is there supposed to be anything else out here?"
"There was a settlement on the northern edge of the flats. A shelter, too. We could perhaps make it in 36 hours if we went straight and fast."
"Are you saying that we should run for safety?"
"Isn't that why you're asking?"
"They are out here. We lost them, but there are others."
He paused, realizing that the words had come without him thinking about them.
You believe that, sir? I mean, really?
Yes,
he began, and heard the truth come wearily out of his mouth.
Because there has to be a reason, doesn't there? A reason for why this all happened? A reason why Horus is fighting the Emperor? A reason why the Iron Warriors came here? A reason why we are here? A reason for where we are going?
Where are we going?
He looked down at where the glass of the Auspex screen blinked with runes.
I don't know.
Sometimes knowing the answers does not help.
No. Perhaps. But we have to believe they exist.
Well, who are you trying to convince, sir? Me or yourself?
Both.
Well, I...
Colonel!
Abbas's voice cut through Origo's. Cord felt the tiredness slide back behind a layer of adrenaline.
I'm getting a signal. Very faint, but it's there. 75 degrees from north.
Cord began to work the vox set. He could hear the signal now, a shift in the tone of the static. There was something there, all right. It sounded like a voice.
All units, this is War Anvil. Engines and weapons live. Heading 75 degrees from north, crescent formation, slow and careful.
They moved out, tracks clattering through slow revolutions. Muttered signals snapped between the machines.
I see something!
Abbas's voice came across after they had gone 5 kilometres.
Steady,
said Cord.
Visual contact,
called Abbas.
Well, it's a tank! Can't identify class.
They moved closer. Cord could almost feel the eyes of every member of the regiment scanning their sights and screens. The faint sound in the static suddenly became a voice.
Please! Help! Can anyone hear?
I don't like it,
Zekanilla's voice cut in.
Why did we not hear their call until now?
Powered down, perhaps, until they saw us,
said Origo.
Keep on heading,
said Cord.
Please. Oh, golden gates of terror,
came the distorted voice.
Please, I can see you. Please.
And then Cord saw it. Sitting beneath a low rise was a Vanquisher, its turret rotated to the side, the tip of its long barrel touching the ground. Dust and corrosion had rubbed the red and black of its heraldic colours into a series of pocked patches.
Acacian linebreakers, said Sasha. Been out here for a while. Can't see any damage.
She was right. The machine looked intact, but it was slumped to one side, its right track submerged beneath the grey crust.
Please, said the voice again. Please. I know you're there. We don't have much power left.
Sir, what are we going to do?
Asked Sasha. Cord was staring at the Vanquisher's hull.
Sir?
All units full stop. Origo, move the scouts close. Get your eyeball pressed against its hull. All other units hold position. Stay sharp.
Cord switched his vox to the frequency the pleading voice was speaking on.
Unknown unit, this is Colonel Cord of the Talon 71st. Please identify.
Thank goodness,
the voice sobbed back. Male, thought Cord.
Thank goodness.
The words crumbled wetly, so that Cord could almost hear the tears.
Identify,
he said again, turning his head to nod at Sasha. She returned the nod and pressed her eyes to her gun sight. The main gun was already loaded.
Gunner Tolson,
the voice gasped.
Acacian 807th. What is your situation?
My situation? Can't you see?
Now listen to me, Tolson. What happened?
Asked Cord. A sob sucked over the vox, but then he heard the man take a series of breaths. When the voice came back, it was steadier.
We ran into an enemy unit running to the east, said the voice.
Cord felt the word shiver over his skin. He was aware that he was holding his breath.
We lost two. We ran. Then the track sunk and we could not get out.
Where is your commander, Tolson?
The man's words caught.
We started to run low on air.
Cord blinked, suddenly aware of the air as it passed over his tongue.
You are alone?
Yes, but I can't drive it. The machine, I mean. I think it could move if it was shunted out.
Cord nodded. The machine looked like it could be pushed out of the soft ground that had caught its track. He keyed the Vox onto another channel.
Origo, tell me what you see.
It's jammed, but could come free.
Anything else out there?
Cord flicked his view to a straight, magnified display down War Anvil's gunsight. Just beyond the stranded tank and the three scattered scout machines, the fog swirled in uneven cliffs and curtains.
Not that I can see, sir,
came Arrigo's reply. Cord nodded to himself.
Abbas,
he said.
Get Gravecall and her dozer blade up here. Shunt the machine out.
Sir,
came the curt reply.
Tolson, we're going to shunt you out of there and get you moving. And then you're coming with us.
He cut the man's tears and thanks off as they started. A second later, Abbas's squadron swept into sight. The dozer-equipped executioner Gravecall was in the lead, its three siblings spread around and behind it in a V. Cord zoomed his view closer, tracking the machines. Getting the stranded tank free, that was one thing, but he was not thinking about that. All that he could think of was the enemy force that the surviving crew member had mentioned. If they could get the man calm enough to work the tank's auspex, he might be able to backtrack to the enemy's last position. There couldn't be many Iron Warriors patrols out in this isolated reach of Talon, and that might mean that they had just stumbled on a lead. Something caught his eye in the fog as he pulled his view back to the stranded tank. He did not know what he had seen. It had been so brief, an image caught as it vanished behind a curtain. He swept the gunsight back. The fog beyond the low dirt ridge had thickened again. His mouth opened. What had it been? Cold on his skin. Had it been a figure? Gravecall was within 10 meters of the stranded tank now.
No, that could not be. Except
his hand found the Vox.
Tolson,
he said, trying to keep his voice steady. The Vox crackled.
How long did it take the air to fail?
Sir?
Tolson's voice was ragged with relief. The Gravecall had rotated its turret so that its gun pointed to its rear, the pistons holding its dozer blade extended, dropping it to the ground.
How long?
The fog parted along the ridge behind the stranded tank. A figure was standing there, still, graphite black, the dust of the drying earth falling from its joints and armor plates. It was not human. It was not even transhuman. It was a cyborg, a thalaxi, and it was looking directly down at Cord.
All units!
The shout roared from his throat. The stranded tank exploded. Jets of molten metal blasted from each face of its hull. The Gravecall blew apart as the jet cut through its hull. A sphere of plasma flew out from the dead machine, struck another tank, and flipped it onto its side like a toy slammed by a child. The cyborg brought its thick-barreled melter gun up and fired. A red neon line split the fog, touched Abbas's tank, and a second brilliant white sphere blinked into being. Cord jerked his head back from the sight as white bright light bored into his retina. War Anvil shook as overlapping blast waves broke over it. There were voices shouting all around him, shouting across the Vox, through the pressed tight space of the tank. He tried to blink away the bright smudges burned into his sight. Beyond them, he could see shapes moving on the auspex screen, red threat marks rising from the dead dust of the ground to close on him. The memory of Perturabo's voice came to Herend as he dreamed.
What are we?
Perturabo asked. The question surprised Herend, but the answer came without thinking.
We are iron.
And what is the purpose of iron?
To endure. To cut.
To be weapons of war.
Perturabo nodded, and turned half away, the plates of his augmented frame flowing over each other. He raised an arm and turned it over, seeming to examine the weapon bonded to its back. Herend did not know the exact design, but recognized Volkite charge disks and energy feeds.
But we are fighting a war that is not like the wars of old. The edge has been taken from our blades, the strength from our shield. The universe we thought existed was a lie.
The dream ended. The lingering image of Perturabo crumbling into the static swirl of fog in his senses. For a second, the feeling of fading dreams and memory lingered, more real than unreal, even as they vanished. He shivered, and his dreadnought frame creaked in sympathy. He turned his head and looked around him, trying to remember where he was and what he was doing. A line of black, jagged rocks rose through the thinning fog to his left, biting up into the air and marching down a slope to a valley floor which waited somewhere out of sight. The assault group were lined up beside him, stationary on the crusted earth slope. The brick slab shape of Spartan 4171 loomed to his left. Oren and Gortan stood a short distance behind him, and the rest of the group's war machines formed a diamond around them. All of them had their engines and systems wound down to minimum power. He remembered where they were now. A voice was talking, the last word it had spoken sliced off at his wakening.
Out a specific target. We could meet resistance in either direction.
He still did not feel fully part of what was going on around him. Reflexively, he checked the time lag since he had last been conscious. Less than a second had passed. He looked at the seconds click past and felt his recent memories return. He and his group were halted in the lower foothills close to an area the humans of Talarn had called Nedan. They had stopped to make the decision on the direction in which they should proceed.
East!
A new voice trembled across the vox, draining down into a panting breath. The voice trailed off, and Herend could feel the silence on the vox thicken uneasily.
"You tell us to go east, Navigator," he asked.
"Yes,"
said the rustling voice. The fingers of both Herend's fists clamped shut at the sound. Even from the vox it was like sand grating over glass.
"The rift opens. Its scent calls. The taste of night is like sugar. East runs the water, though there is no stream. Only the eyes, eyes like the dark bright moon."
"Silence,"
he growled, and the navigator went quiet. Herend had only seen the creature once, as it was being loaded onto Spartan 4171. It was not an experience he wished to repeat. It had moved with an irregular grace, gliding, twitching, and veering without discernible pattern. The exposed flesh of its head and hands was grey, and crazed with black veins which stood proud of the skin. A metal plate covered its forehead, keeping its third eye locked behind closed plasteel leaves. The eyes beneath were blood-red from edge to edge, the irises a broken swirl at the heart of each. Herend knew its name, Hez Tal. He, for it had been a male, was one of the navigators who had been at the tillers of Perturabo's fleet as it had plunged into the black star at the heart of the Eye of Terror. They had still had their third eyes open when the ships fell into that other space. It had killed many of them, and altered the ones who remained. Black Oculus Navigators was what the Primarch had called them. Herend had become one of the few that knew of their existence when he had accepted this quest. It was an honour he did not relish. Whenever he had to interact with the altered navigator, he felt a hunger to be ignorant of their existence again. But without Heztal, their task was impossible. The navigator could see, or sense, what they sought, though that sense seemed as erratic as the creature himself.
"We turn east," said Herend into the waiting fox.
He began to walk. The tracks of the tanks began to turn.
"Ironclad,"
the navigator's voice slid into his ear.
"Yes."
"I see you, Ironclad."
Herend heard the words, and suddenly was sure he could feel something inside his sarcophagus, something delicate tracing lines across the chewed remains of his skin, something with long, thin fingers. The navigator's voice returned.
"I see you, a morsel of flesh pulled from the Death Father's mouth. I see you curled in your tomb. I see you dream."
Herend saw the land around him, but suddenly everything was different. The fog stripped back as if burned away by sunlight. Everything was brilliant and clear and bright. Everything was burning. His feet were moving, and beside him the block shapes of Sycorans, predators, and Venator hulls shimmered in pools of shadow. Sounds came to him as he looked at them, sounds like the snicker of blade edges and the rattle song of bullets feeding into a gun.
"What?"
he began, but the word hung on its own because the navigator's voice came again.
"I see you. I see the hole. I see the seed. And I..."
The voice trailed away. Herend's sight suddenly cleared, and the sensation of fingers stirring the fluid around his body vanished. He was striding over the ground, his senses peeling back the fog, not with light, but with the stark stream of scrolling data. He knew without knowing why the navigator within the Spartan had turned its gaze from him.
"What?"
he said again, as though clearing it from a jammed thought.
"I see you, and I..."
whispered Heztal, as though falling asleep.
"And I am sorry."
Herend marched on, following a line into the east, trying not to hear the navigator's words scratch at the back of his thoughts. The master of Core Reach 1 came to Argonis in his chamber complex. The rooms were three levels down, in a region of the Sightless Warren that had been the first to be assimilated into the buried fortress. The Sapphire City Shelter had been its name before, but the Iron Warriors had stripped it of that name when they had remade it. Core Reach 1 was its new title, and the blunt efficiency of the 4th Legion now pervaded its every corner. Work details moved through its corridors in tight groups, hauling loads of shells, armor plates, and provisions to the areas that would need them. Harsh light and fresh air billowed through the passages and chambers from repaired and carefully maintained lighting and ventilation systems. Every door and lift shaft had a guard. Most were from the human regiments bound to the Legion. The Iron Skull and bonded unit numbers marked their armor and skin. Legionaries watched over more vital areas, flanking doors or looking out onto chambers like worn steel statues. Argonis and his entourage had been given a cluster of sparse chambers close to the central command areas. They had been permitted to go wherever they pleased, and no one had questioned their presence anywhere. The Eye of Horus opened all doors. Even so, they had learned nothing besides the manifest truth that Talarn was a battlefield, which gave up victories sparingly and drank the blood of all who trod her surface. Argonis had walked the miles of the Sightless Warren, had reviewed battle plans and seen caverns filled with troops and machines. None of it had told him anything, besides the fact that the 4th Legion were trying to win Talarn the way they always won wars, by battering their enemies to ruin. He had found nothing. No suspicious facts, no concealment, nothing. Had his instinct been wrong? Was the truth they were hunting a ghost? It had been the Tech Witch who had suggested that they change their approach. Argonis had resisted, but as the days became weeks and the weeks clustered into months, he had agreed that there was no alternative. If there was something hidden, then looking at the surface of things was going to tell them nothing. They had to peel the skin off and look beneath, and that meant that they were about to do something that brought a taste of bile to his tongue when he thought about it. He turned when the chamber doors opened. The iron warrior who entered was a little shorter than most space marines, and the face was a flattened lump of scars and stitch marks. A blank silver ball stared out from where his left eye should have been, while the right met Argonis's with pale green coldness. A crimson and yellow centurion plume rose from the plough-fronted helm, held under the newcomer's left arm, and his right rested on the pommel of a sheathed short sword. Bronze lightning bolts split the dirty iron of his breastplate and shoulder guard. Behind him stood two warriors in the chevroned bronze of the Legion Elite. The iron warrior's name was Volk, and he held command over much of the sightless warren, and he was there because Argonis had summoned him. Argonis waited. After a long second, Volk spoke.
"The commander of Corps Reach One gives honour and greetings to the emissary of the War Master of Mankind."
Volk bowed his head, just enough to show respect, but not enough to imply deference.
"Oh, the honour is ours, and we give you thanks for the efforts you have made to aid our mission."
Argonis bowed his helmeted head, careful to make sure the gesture was not as deep as Volk's. The relative depth of his bow told everyone present where the higher authority lay. Most importantly, it told Volk. Behind him he heard a rustle as Sota Nul bowed in turn.
"It is pleasing to see that you have come in person to ensure that our latest request is met."
Volk's expression flickered, his scarred features rippling.
"We deny you nothing, emissary, but I do not understand how this request is relevant."
"He is not unintelligent, this one," said Sota Nul,
her voice a private whisper from his helm's vox.
"That could be problematic."
He ignored it.
"Relevant?"
He let the word hang in the air.
"Everything is relevant."
He watched a muscle twitch under Volk's metal eye.
"If he will not comply, there are other ways, methods that can be used,"
Sota Nul said in his ear.
"The primary armories are yours to see, all 72 of them."
Argonis nodded, still not breaking eye contact.
"The Lord of Iron has laid his preparations for war well." "As always."
"A long war."
"For whatever might be needed."
"Need is decided by who is judging that need." Volk laughed, the deep sound growling through the bare chamber. His armoured frame shook with the sound. Argonis saw broken stubs of teeth flash in the crooked line of Volk's mouth.
"Do you ever let an opportunity to sound like an arrogant cur pass?"
"Sometimes." Argonis reached up and unfastened his helm. He smiled himself then, stepped forward and clasped Volk's extended fist in his own.
"But you provide so many opportunities it would seem impolite." "Does Chthonia only breed weaklings with sharp tongues, or is it just you? And does Olympia still just breed halfwits and siege dross?" "Ha! Only the best of both."
Volk's scars twisted into a smile again.
"It is good to see you. Even in all of this, brother, it is good to see you."
"All this?"
"For this war. It is a long way from Carmeline and the Redis Cluster."
Volk let a breath hiss from his nose and shook his head.
"A long way along a strange path."
"It is," said Argonis, holding his expression and head still.
"And things change." "Yes, they do."
Volk said the words carefully, frowning.
"You come from the War Master, in person, as a bearer of his presence. Somehow I never thought that kind of honour would be yours."
"Oh, neither did I." Volk raised an eyebrow but did not press the point.
"And as you can see, I have had my wings clipped. A hawk on an iron perch."
He grinned and tapped the metal sphere of his left eye and then pointed at Argonis.
"But even with just one eye, I could still tear you out of the sky."
"I doubt it.
Unless half-blindness has somehow improved your skill as a pilot." "Ho-ho!
So the high orbits of command have not taken your claws. Good.
Do they still call you, what was that ridiculous title? The Unscarred? That was it, wasn't it?
Argonis smiled briefly, and then allowed his face to harden into seriousness.
What happened?
He asked.
Since Istvan. What happened to the fourth?
I went to the Caithian Gulf after the massacre.
Volk closed the fingers of his hand with a clack of ceramite on ceramite.
Broke the holdings around Selgar. But the Primarch summoned us here, and so here I am. I am sure that all of our activities are fully known by the War Master.
He shrugged and did not look back at Argonis.
Well, things have changed, old friend, said Argonis.
Civil war will do that,
Volk nodded, his mouth a hard line. Argonis thought of the squadron master he had known and fought with for almost a decade. The warrior in front of him was the same, still the combination of wit and brutality that seemed at odds with his Olympian birth. But there was a weight there now, as though thoughts he could not speak were churning within.
Why are you here? Why is your legion fighting this battle?
You have asked the Primarch that?
Argonis nodded.
Then you have your answer.
The Iron Warrior turned and made for the door. From far off, a distant rumble shook the still air. A thin thread of dust fell from the ceiling. Everyone in the room looked upwards.
A surface bombardment, said Sotanul. They are attacking again, as predicted.
Volk's eyes flicked to her, then back to Argonis.
You have unusually poor timing on this occasion, brother. My attention will be needed soon, but the armories are open to your inspection. Emissary.
The hard note of formality had returned to his voice, and he gave an abrupt gesture to one of his two guards.
Taldak will be your guide.
My thanks, said Argonis.
Volk bowed in reply, and then he turned and was gone out of the door. Argonis looked at Taldak's blank, masked face and clamped his own helm over his head. Sotanul's transmitted voice spoke to him as soon as the helmet's connections closed.
That one is dangerous and clever.
He always was,
he replied, making for the door. Taldak fell in before him, his bolter held low in his hands.
His presence and the presence of this guide may cause us complications.
I'm not sure I will tolerate what you are implying.
They crossed the door out of the chamber and began to walk down the curving passage beyond. An alert alarm began to sound. Yellow lights began to strobe in the ceiling. Another tremor ran through the floor. Despite himself, he felt adrenaline spiking his blood.
You should overcome your reluctance,
purred Sotanul.
We might need to kill more than him.
There will be no need.
There may be every need,
she said. Io felt elation as she watched the emissary and heard the tech witch's words. The emotion washed through her, raw and burning. She had to slice it out of her awareness before it corrupted the calculations. Her primary phase manipulation had worked. It had worked. Even if she denied her emotions, she could not deny that truth. True danger lives in the moment when you feel invulnerable. The aphorism floated through her thoughts, even as she refocused her mind. There were many, many reasons why she should not feel victorious. Her own security was tenuous at best. The Iron Warriors controlled the tunnels of the sightless warren with ruthless precision. While the Loyalists were scattered and broken into different commands, the Iron Warriors infused every aspect of their operations with control. Security was not simply tight. It was a coordinated pattern of overlapping countermeasures and contingencies. Guard patterns changed. Movements of personnel and materiel were continually catalogued and cross-checked. Sweep and search patrols probed deserted areas at random. She'd only seen comparable compliancy once before, and that had been during a short-lived incursion onto the Phalanx several decades before. She could not help but admire the craft in the Fourth Legion's paranoia. Despite how aesthetically pleasing the sightless warren's countermeasures were, they had slowed her progress. She had overcome the problem in the end by making a series of bolt holes in places where safety only came from the ludicrousness of trying to use them as hideouts. The skull space of a Reaver Titan of Legio Furens undergoing repair was her bolt hole for the first two cycles. A set of faulty decontamination airlocks proved most useful, as did the piles of damaged and blood-marked hulls awaiting repair. She moved between these locations according to purely random patterns. It was not ideal, but it was the best solution she could achieve. She had needed to establish a workable pattern of evasion before she had been able to turn her energies to the emissary. At first, she had thought that she would need to find a way to reach one of the Iron Warrior's ships, but that had proved unnecessary. The emissary was there, in the sightless warren. The Tech Witch had been a problem at first. Her presence had killed a dozen netflies before Io had compensated. Once she had done that, she'd been able to throw her awareness over the trio and begin to squeeze for data. Every movement they made, she saw. Every word they said, every signal they thought private, all of it went to Io. She began to build prediction profiles and individual data models of Argonis and his entourage. They lived in her skull, shadows projected by the living creatures she watched. The model of the astropath, called Prophesius, was a sketch of ephemeral possibilities. She was almost certain that the creature was not fully human, or that its nature had altered substantially, probably by psychic means. In its actions, she had seen total obedience. There were also signs that it had almost no self-determination beyond the ability to obey commands. The mask locked to its skull was clearly not a simple device. She had also decided not to remember the shape details of the runes cut into the mask's metal. Looking at them had distorted her thoughts. But even though the data model was thin, it gave her enough to deduce Prophesius's role and importance. The astropath was a link between the emissary and Horus himself, but a link that had yet to be used. Sota Nul was another matter. She was like no other tech priest Io had encountered. Her physiology was at variance to her kind. There was as much of the biological about Sota Nul as there was mechanical. The line between the flesh and metal was also narrow. That was also unusual, almost unprecedented. Almost. Then there were her speech patterns. She had a human voice, produced not by machine or vox, but by air, throat, and mouth. Io was certain of this. She could hear it in the texture of Sota Nul's words. But she'd never heard her breathe. Worst of all were Sota Nul's decision-stroke-reaction patterns. Where the rest of her kind often eschewed emotion in favour of logic, the Tech Witch seemed to follow both instinct and logic in ways that Io found hard to predict. She did things because of calculation and because of emotions such as anger, hunger, and spite. That was not good. It was not good at all. All the little factors meant that Sota Nul could only be one thing. She was one of the reborn of Mars, one of the so-called new priesthood. The Dark Mechanicum. Then there was Argonis, beautiful Argonis, so filled with the echoing martial pride of a lost age. He was a warrior, noble, loyal, focused, ruthless, but he was also a betrayer with blood on his hands. He was so loyal, yet so bound to his own principles, a person cut in two and then bound back together. She was not certain, but there were indicators that he had not been sent to Talarn as an honour, but as a penance, or as a form of exile. She wanted to know why. She wanted to know why very badly indeed. There was possibility in that silent space. The possibility of death and mayhem. Sometimes when she played recordings of his voice over and over, she thought she could almost see the truth. A hidden shape, betrayed by its shadow. Between these three, she could feel her projections spiral and whirl. She knew almost all that they knew. She knew they had contact with the Alpha Legion operative Yalen, and that they did not trust him, that they almost believed that everything they saw on Talon was a lie. And of course it was.